Hi, this is Dallas. Welcome to the Wildlife Herd Podcast, Episode 6, that we're calling Timber Management and Wildlife Considerations. This week, we have a great discussion with guest Noonie Ford about a wide range of timber management topics, from picking a consultant, timber markets, basic management concepts, and considerations when managing your forest with a wildlife goal. This is a great discussion, and we hope you enjoy it.
This podcast was a mess.
So today we'd like to welcome our guest, Noonie Ford, or Alexandra.
Welcome, having me.
So today, we decided we would talk a little bit about balancing timber management and wildlife, since this is something that a lot of our landowners are dealing with. And we know there's a lot of trade-offs no matter what you're doing, whether you're doing commercial timber management versus wildlife timber management. And so I think we've talked a little bit about that. So, but first, let's introduce yourself. Tell us what you do.
Sure. I'm Noonie Ford. I was born and raised in North Florida, so I pretend to be from Georgia originally. But I grew up, you know, working bird dogs in the woods and just always enjoyed being outside. That's where I got to spend time with my dad when he had time off. I've got four brothers, but I was on hunting fish with dad and always called me the good old boy. So that kind of segued into like, oh, you can actually have a career in working in the woods. And I actually went to forestry school in Missoula, Montana, where a lot of the students were shocked that we plant trees in rows down here. And I was shocked that they don't. But so I graduated from Montana in 2012 and came back home to Georgia and started working with the Georgia Forestry Commission. Initially as a county forester, and I worked my way up to like stewardship special legacy. And
nice. Good. So that was a culture shock going from Georgia to Montana.
Yeah, sure. But I like in my first day of dendrology class, the professor says his favorite two trees are live oaks and longleaf.
That's a shock.
Yeah. So, but then he did ask me, he's like, how do you say this tree? And I was like, I know you want me to say pecan, but my mom taught me to say pecan. I brought back Spanish moss after Christmas break and stuff because they'd never seen it before. So, yeah.
To give everybody a chance.
Yeah. He goes, can you bring us some Spanish moss? I was like,
off the ground or off the tree?
Yeah. I was like, well, they'll have, I'm not getting those red bugs, those chiggers. And they're like, what? Chiggers. And so there's like these red bugs that just get all over you. And I mean, they get every crevice of your body. It's horrible. But so I ended up, I think I tricked my now husband because he's from like North Georgia. So he didn't quite understand. Yeah. So when he was visiting, I think for Christmas break, he littered up some.
Gosh. Put a little seven dust in it to kill the chiggers off.
And yeah.
It always gives me the willies when I see a floral arrangement with
all of that. It's like my best friend got married and her dad had just spent time killing the Japanese climbing fern on their property. And then here she comes walking down the aisle and it's full of Japanese climbing ferns.
We just talked about this last week. Well, that's episode.
Yep.
That's hilarious.
But yeah, it was more of a culture shock for everybody out there. I was a culture shock to them.
Yeah.
So that was kind of fun because I'd spent some summers in Jackson Hole. So I kind of understood it, but they didn't. They were surprised. We'd watch a TV show and they're like, oh, they must be near you. Look at that accent. I'm like, no, that's an Alabama accent. They're like, there's different Southern accents.
Yeah. Some you can understand, some you can't.
And usually we're like, all the grits were at the grocery store. It was all like shredded oats. And one, like, you know, 5 minute quick pack of grits. It was the food, I guess, their lack of like okra or something. But I was more of a shock to them.
And now putting milk in the grits.
No, you gotta make it.
There is a small spot in Idaho, northern Idaho, that has sweet tea. Mm.
They're starting to get Chick-fil-A's in Idaho, too, I think.
This is
diabetes tea across the country.
All about it, man. We love it. I know which restaurants have sweet tea in Idaho.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. It was good, though, to just kind of learn, because we would go to a lot of the job sites and just see the different, like, you know, forestry machinery out there compared to down here. Like a lot of the stuff that you see and for like swamp logging down here is what you'd see out there because it's track, long arms and stuff like that. It's a fella bunch that you usually see in upland.
A little different topography to deal with.
Yeah.
It's interesting because, you know, when we're at national meetings, we have completely different views of things.
Yes.
That's why. We just don't understand each other's.
At all. And, you know, like the lack of prescribed fire out there. And, you know, you drive a close distance, quote, you know, well, it's a quick 5-hour drive to Washington and it's just beetle kill everywhere, wildfire kill everywhere. And you're just trying to start doing what we're doing down here. But they are really big, more, I think, than they are down here about washing off the forestry equipment to help prevent invasives, which I hope we start to get better at. But yeah, I think it was, I tell myself it was a good decision to learn something so different, like, and know something so different, but also to learn something so different and able to have kind of both of that in somewhere in my brain.
Yeah. It's good to have that diversity and understand how things work in different parts of the country.
Yeah.
And we were talking about, I think, in the first episode was how viewpoints change with conservation depending on where you're from.
Yeah.
So, you know, cutting trees out west for some of those areas, oh, God, you just don't do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And for us, it's a row crop.
Basically. Yeah. I didn't think about it till then. But then I remember growing up, our neighborhood was like an old plantation. And so I would just run barefoot through the woods and just absolutely loved it. And, you know, watch Fern Gully growing up. And so I come home one day and all these trees are flagged. So I was like, Dad, what's happening? He's like, oh, they're going to come in and cut some of these trees. And I freaked out, was like ripping the ribbons off the trees. And I was like, this is I didn't know. I'm like, oh, that was very beneficial to the trees and the wildlife. So it's just kind of funny how it's just funny, like looking back where I was so against it just because of things I've seen growing up and like preaching.
Yeah.
Well, I coming down to Georgia from Massachusetts is the same thing.
Yeah.
But that's why I came down here.
Yeah.
Because the management was what was needed up there.
Yeah.
And I always intended on going back and nope, I stayed down here. Sorry, everyone.
I know. Everybody's like, everybody's like, why did you come back from Dana? I was like, I mean, that was always the plan, and it's a different ball game for Timberman down here.
But even as professionals, we need to make sure, like, if there's a field day and we can get to it at a meeting far away, like, go.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Heck yeah.
Top, like, structure is the same. Structure is structure, you know, but then you learn so much, and I'm surprised to hear that you were out there.
I worked in Jackson Hole like summer of 08 and 09, and that was like when the economy busted, so tourism wasn't great.
Good time to be there.
Yeah, not if you're working.
Right.
But our boss, it's actually a family from Tallahassee that has a guest ranch out there. She was like, if y'all don't like travel to Glacier while you're here, like you're all fired, you're all done. So went, drove through Missoula. I was like, hello, this is a great town. And came home that August and realized that they had a forestry school, and that's kind of what I was looking into because I was in Athens at the time. Got in and packed up and stayed there for like 2.5
months. Awesome.
Yeah, absolutely loved it.
Beautiful place. We chased a little squirrel that we normally
chase.
That's right.
No, but it's all very, you know, sort of.
Good.
That's right. Yeah. Good information and ties into stuff we've talked about in the past and kind of segues into what we were talking about was, you know, with timber management and wildlife and the viewpoints being different, but down here, we do have to cut trees to manage for wildlife. So I guess to start with, let's discuss what commercial timber management kind of looks like.
Commercial timber management, there's going to probably be less fire, which obviously takes away from wildlife habitat, and just kind of probably even less herbicide. As long as they can get their machines in there to cut the trees, they're fine with it. Whereas like your private landowners, so that's like your timberland companies, you know, your Weyerhaeuser, Plum Creek, stuff like that. Your private landowners that are actually like using the land, they're going to hopefully, you know, with knowledge and help from, you know, forestry commission consultants, they're going to be burning pine tree can or the understory at least. And so a little bit more hands-on approach, I believe, and not just counting up. If a timber company puts in less money in the timber stand, then they'll have more return later.
Right.
It can be wildlife friendly, but it's a little less.
Yeah. So we know prescribed fire is good for wildlife and when you're managing that. Do you see a benefit from your timber if you burn and reduce some of that competition?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And you can see it just if you cut it. When you look at a tree stump, you can see when there were fires or when you took away some of that competition. And it started to grow like some bigger tree rings and stuff like that. So it's removing that competition. It's kind of like weeding a garden, in my opinion.
Right.
Taking down that competition and also obviously kind of naturally fertilizing.
Yeah. And so the other thing, I guess, is the rotation of the timber. So harvest, when you're looking at a commercial stand, what's kind of your standard harvest rotation?
In our area in Southwest Georgia, you'll probably get three harvests. You'll plant, you know, loblolly, slash, or longleaf, and loblolly and slash, you can have your first thinning at 13 to 15, depending on what you've got. Longleaf will be a little bit later. But after that first thinning, it's, I don't know, an average of about 7 years till the next thinning. And if you want to, you can have that saw timber and clear cut by like 32, 35 years old. As long as you've got the markets for it, like we do here in Southwest Georgia. In Southeast Georgia, it's basically just a pulp market. So these landowners and commercial timberland, they're growing it to 15 years and clear cutting and starting it.
That's something that, you know, I always kind of knew, but looking at some of the maps of where the different mills were across the state recently in the last couple of years, it's like really drives home how our markets mm-hmm. vary across our state, yeah. even within Georgia. And
in the nation. Because, you know, out west where they stopped doing a lot of timber harvesting, the mills went away. So, mm-hmm. like, you know, we're arguing to start burning and thinning these stands. But if they do, there's nowhere to take the trees because there's no more mills.
Yeah.
If you're paying to destroy
trees, yeah.
which is the worst thing.
Right. It's because of waste.
Yeah.
You can't utilize it, which is mm-hmm. you don't want to do.
Well, I think we're starting to see a little bit like more of the backyard sawmills.
Yeah. And we need to, because that'll help, I think, pricing as well, because we're seeing a lot of Canadian companies coming down and buying our mills, and the other ones are nearby shutting down, so they're the ones that are picking the price. It's either you get a little bit of money for your trees or no money at all.
Yeah, and if that's, you know, my husband's in construction, so we watch the price of wood and products, and it's skyrocketing, and when you get the stickers back, it's all Canada.
Yeah.
You know, and we've done it to ourselves.
Yeah, correct. Like, you know, it's the Canadian companies that are making all the money. The prices of lumber is more expensive, but the landowners aren't getting any more money than they were.
Right. Because they're essentially having to eat it through diesel.
Yeah,
to get back.
And insurance for the logging is so expensive now, so they're not offering a lot of money because they've got to pay. Like, it's just.
Yeah. I was listening to somebody talking about how much it cost them to insure their trucks and their drivers and all the stuff now. And that's a huge cost that you don't really think about. And then you add in fuel. When you got these mills, like North Georgia, some of the ones that are having to take them all the way across Atlanta.
Yeah.
But you can't go through Atlanta with some of the trucks.
No.
You got to go all the way out and around.
Well, you know, my dad drove a log truck for years. And watching that work, I can see why it's expensive. But they're longer in load.
Yeah.
So they can't go certain places that other semis can go.
Yep, and
they have raised the tonnage, I guess, that's allowable, or they're trying to.
Yeah.
But there was, our neighbors have a conservation easement, and they were logging on there, and I was talking to the logger. He's like, I just paid $500,000 for our insurance for the company. He goes, I've got to pay that twice a year.
Yeah.
Wow.
While he was sitting there fixing his feller buncher.
Yeah.
He's like, it's so expensive.
Yeah, equipment. Yeah. Repair cost. And the equipment itself is insane. My dad's in agriculture, so just I know what a tractor costs. Cool. So throw something even bigger in, all that yellow equipment is insane. And then fixing something because, you know, a small part costs you a couple $1,000s.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's insanity. But within the timber management, you know, depending again where you are, where your mills are, whether you've got a pulp mill, I guess, you know, with longleaf, we see some of them go to more poles. Mm-hmm. You do see some of the other trees will, but I guess longleaf is more suitable for pole maybe than some of the others.
Some were taking loblolly too and slash, but I guess just a little bit slower growing.
Or straighter. Yeah. Good poles.
But I mean, in the grand scheme of things, in what is those extra years?
Yeah.
You know, in for price fluctuations and everything else, you can usually, I'd rather bank on a tree that I know is going to be a good product than one if you miss that window.
Yeah.
You lose your value.
Yeah. Absolutely. Like, if, you know, slash, if you've got a landowner that hasn't been around, or, you know, it's newly purchased or inherited land, and that slash has been suppressed for long, those don't recover. Like loblolly and longleaf will kind of generally recover if you go in there and thin it, but slash, you must start over.
Yeah. I've seen that with some stands. They were waiting for the price to come back.
And then
waiting the price. And then, you've got the suppressed trees.
Mm-hmm. We have a project that we all work on that we've been telling them for 10 years, you're going to miss it. And what's happening? They've missed it. They have beetles.
Well, trees within themselves.
Yeah.
We see that. So every time a tree falls over, that's lost profit.
Yeah. And then that's just sign that you've got stressed trees. If you've got stressed trees, you've got a good chance of beetles coming in now, especially with how hot these periods of drought.
Yeah, so that's one thing with wildlife is we recommend not just the burning, but the thinning to put the sunlight on the ground. So that comes into consideration depending on what the landowner's goals are. We all have to pay the taxes on the property. You've got cost for land management. So some people, or I'll say most people, have some sort of balance between the two.
Right.
You've got to make some sort of money off your timber. What used to be thought of as an investment for the future is no longer that.
No.
You don't use timber as an investment anymore. No. The money's not there. But can
Unless
offset
you
your
cost.
Right.
Your average owner doesn't
right.
have.
Right, you're not going to retire.
Kids to college.
Yeah, I just thin some, and yeah, I'm not retiring off of that.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, no. But that's something that we have to keep in mind when we're asking landowners to thin for wildlife, because you can thin to different levels and still benefit wildlife, depending on what your goals are. So basically, I think we've talked about it before, but basically, that's the square footage of timber on an acre, which kind of translates to trees per acre based on their size. So with wildlife, when we're managing, we're looking at fewer trees per acre because we want the sunlight on the ground. Of course, fewer trees per acre also impacts your economics.
Yeah, less money. And again, just what I know in Southwest Georgia is if we know we've got a landowner that wants a balance of, you know, timber income and wildlife, we recommend that thinning to get in like 60 area.
Right.
And that provides a good bit of sunlight for a few years, and then obviously opens up the stand for those trees to start growing really well, but not taking out too much to where you don't have a good income for the next harvest.
Yeah.
Again, that's a lot between. I think 60 is kind of what I was taught, and I've seen some people recommend 70, but your quail plantations are going to go down to 30 just because they just care about wildlife for those hunting areas. They
right.
might have some younger stands where there's going to be some timber income to help pay for some of the cost of the plantation. But generally, if it's strictly for like quail hunting, it's going to be.
Yeah, lower the better for quail.
Yeah, you don't.
A lot of the bird studies are showing that 60 is like your
very top.
Yeah,
okay.
where you can be for a huge fleet of species.
Yeah.
You know, and even see quail, depending on what it is, you know, at 60. But again, you said it depends on their objectives.
Right.
And what it is for that area.
And 70 is considered our trigger point.
Mm-hmm.
For thinning for quail.
Okay.
And so I like going down to 60 if they have, you know, a balance of economics and timber. That gives you a little bit more time in between your thinnings before you've got canopy closure again.
And I guess for a reference, you want to thin when it gets to 120. So that's when it's all shaded out. So you're cutting, if it gets to 120, you cut down to 60, you're cutting that in half. So just, I guess, for reference.
Yeah.
The listeners out.
Well, and you've got to think about, too, like what suite of, if your birds, so I'm bird heavy. So what do I want? Do I want like woodland species of birds, or am I wanting savanna species of birds?
Yeah.
So you can talk your landowner through like which suite of species of birds you want to be seeing throughout the year.
Yeah, and that's why it's really good to talk with your landowner, see what, you know, they might not be big into hunting, but their wife might be a big bird watcher, or their grandkids might be getting into hunting. So you kind of want to figure out what their target species are, and kind of show them how you can manage different areas of your property a little differently to help to make it a little bit more advantageous for the wildlife that they're wanting.
Yeah, and even for speaking to the landowners, is if deer are your goal, you still want to thin.
Correct.
Like you said, you're at canopy closure.
Groceries.
Yeah.
Deer don't eat pine straw.
They don't eat
All right. So to get that sunlight on the ground, even for deer and especially for turkeys, you still need to thin. You could probably carry a little higher basal area if deer are your primary goal than you would if bobwhites are your goal. So talking with your consultant, your forester, biologist, whoever, about what your goals are, and then meeting that balance between economics and your harvest. And one thing I thought about when you were talking about, you know, thinning and allowing the trees to grow, is that's another benefit.
Right.
Is that gives them room and less competition so that you have better quality trees in the future.
So if you know, it's kind of like I said earlier, your garden, if you want your tomatoes to grow well, you got to cut down the competition around it.
Yeah.
Or, you know, plant some also, and like with wildlife too, if you want your tomatoes to grow well, you want to plant some good companion seeds. So generally, if you've got that, if you've reintroduced fire, if it wasn't there for a while, but if you got that fire going, the correct species will hopefully start coming back up, complement whatever.
So, and then, you know, one of the other things that maybe you could speak to is also diversifying your stand. So
right.
making sure you have mixed age How would that structure look?
That, I guess we call it uneven age stages. So you've got that. What the really good species for uneven age management is longleaf. Because you can have that burning in there when those young pines are growing and it's going to be fine. It's a little bit harder with loblolly and slash because that fire is going to kill those young. But I think it's really important if you've got enough acreage is to have different ages stance. Not only from an ecological standpoint of being able to burn and thin at separate times, it's also different timing for in potential angles later on and the less of a monoculture.
So diversifying your portfolio.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The insurance policy too, because look at what happened with the tornadoes.
Yeah, also true.
You know,
yeah.
Came through or hurricane.
The hurricanes.
What I'm thinking about, you know, the ones that had that diversified, you know, timber approach, so they still have some trees that are,
yeah, they might be the only ones, in the area that have those, that, you know, size timber now.
So, you know, from a wildlife standpoint, one of the things that we've been seeing is with red cockaded woodpeckers.
Okay.
On some of the plantations of the trees are, you know, if we put the inserts in the loblolly, those trees are dying and there's no big trees coming up for those birds. So, because it was all even age.
Yeah, I think about that.
So you've got,
so they're probably more opposed to being longleaf stands anyways because they're naturally uneven age.
I mean, that's great for them because those, you know, longleaf doesn't really have a lifespan. Goes and goes.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, the more commercial trees, other commercial trees.
Yeah, your southern, most of your southern pines have a lot shorter lifespan.
Yeah.
There's a lot loblolly, a lot shorter. Yeah. And we see, you know, when you've got kind of a monoculture, all even age across the landscape, when it comes time to do management, it's a lot harder. We've seen that on one of our management areas, that all the trees are coming up on the same time, and they're getting older. So like I say, they're reaching that lifespan, even though we've gone past what the standard commercial forestry would be. What we're seeing is now they're reaching the end of the age on loblollies, and we need to convert. But how do you then now convert when the entire property is all the same? So then you wind up having to do either a patch clear cut. So then you have large areas that are now in canopy closure and not great for wildlife or hunting or anything all at the same time. Or
it's
you try to manage. Right. So it's, you've got to get yourself into a.
And you've got to do it in size where loggers want to come in. So if it's less than probably nowadays 40 acres, they're not going to want to come in because it costs them to bring their equipment in.
Right.
Yeah. We can't get anybody on us right now.
Yeah. And I'm trying to work with creating like a cost share program to pay the loggers to come to these small parcels. Yeah. But it's.
Well, while we're talking about that, is one of the things that often we'll recommend is if you are a small landowner and your neighbor is thinning.
Yes.
Tie in with that neighbor and get, which that's what we did because I had left some residual timber on part of our property and I knew that I wasn't going to get them back in just to cut it. So when he left, I was like, if you come back out in a few years, cut the neighbor's, stop by and get mine.
Yes.
And so he called me a while back and said, hey, we're over here. It's on a little dead end dirt road. I'm going to swing by. I'll stop by and grab yours as a real man if you want to do that. So take half of it and let's go.
Yeah.
See, we're surrounded by it.
Yeah.
So we don't have a neighbor that's going
to. Well, and that's how I've got easements up in Pike County, is on the Flint River up there where he just couldn't. And another, that's another area, like some of the mills are shut down. So it's been really hard to get loggers just in that area of Georgia. Same thing that he was driving past a property nearby and they were cutting. So he went and like talked to the logger.
Yes.
Talked to the forester. So since they were in the area, they're now coming to his property to thin just because they're in there. So like that's really, really important. And also it's kind of if you see a timber stand that looks really nice, that's a really good billboard for the loggers and a billboard for if they use a consulting forester. So like if you see something like that you really like and you don't see a bunch of skinned up trees and you don't see any forks things in there, like the right trees were taken, it's really important to reach out to that landowner to find out who they, to maybe if you've got somebody nearby to use.
Yeah.
It's just really important to know your neighbors when you've got, especially small acreage, to kind of piggyback off of them. And if you like what you see, then piggyback off who they use.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's something I wanted to ask about was, you know, as a landowner, how do you select a buyer or a consultant?
Yeah.
Because that is very important. Like you said, skinned up trees, your roadways.
Roads. It's, you know, we've got Georgia Forestry Commission, like gatrees.org has like a section on our webpage where it's got people, you know, your timber buyers and your loggers in your area, but we can't, you know, promote anybody.
Right.
So that's why it's really important to do search that way. Like, especially if you're approached by somebody, that's what I've seen. You really need to do your research.
Let's talk about that. The letters in the mail.
Yeah. Daily. I'm going to buy your property.
Yeah. I've seen, and I know the guy that trained me originally, that was a consulting forester in Albany. He's like, I know of another consultant that perused the obituaries and looked to see if that family had timberland somewhere and then reach out to usually the widow. And very aware.
Because they're going to high grade, which I guess we should define what high grade is.
Yeah. So high grade is when the loggers come in and they take the most valuable trees, because in their mind, you know, if they're one and done, they don't really care to come back. So they're going to get us what you got now. Saw one in Sumter County. I don't think that they knew they got taken advantage of.
Yeah. I've dealt with one before. It was an older lady whose son knew somebody who was in the logging business, came in and high graded and skint up everything that was left. And she was furious when she finally saw it.
Yeah. It's really, really important. I'm that type of person anyways where I, like, before I buy a watch, I research for, like, 6 months, like, in the summer. Like, when hopefully you love or you want your kids to love, grandkids to love, like, you want to make sure it's done by the right people. So I really push if you get approached by somebody to do some research, if you agree. Because, you know, you see people, we made $50,000. Like, yeah, but it was worth $250,000.
Yeah. And, you know, that brings up the next point, like, yes, your consulting forester, that professional might take a cut.
Right.
But it is absolutely worth it.
And there's been studies where, like, you know, especially nowadays where people have been, consulting foresters have been coming back to the same places where, like, this place was operator selected in the neighboring property. I did the first thinning. I marked it. And we're making $1,000 more per acre than the neighboring property.
Yeah.
So, in my opinion, that first thinning is the most important one to have done by a good consulting forester, because maybe you'll make a little less money because you're paying a consultant initially, but you're going to make it back tenfold the next two harvests.
Yeah. Well, and they also, you know, with a consultant, they watch the markets. Mm-hmm. They know, so they can find those good ups and downs.
My oldest brother is a wealth manager in Atlanta, and he and I could not be any more different. He thinks I work like a tree nerd. He doesn't understand it. And I was explaining to him, I was like, I do what you do. Like, I help landowners do what you do, where, like, I'm looking at the market and the age of their trees, and, you know, it's time to thin. And he's like, oh, I finally get it. He's like, that makes sense, because our bank owns timberland. I was like,
you hire someone like me.
Yeah, you hire someone like me.
I love myself.
We try to be, you know, quote, investment bankers or wealth managers for these landowners, and make sure the consultant, or, you know, that's what a consultant does, is they make sure that you're cutting at the right time, or just sometimes you just have to cut at that point.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's a smaller tract and there's somebody to buy, or it's about to be absolutely out of control. But they, if it's a good one, they do their best to make sure you make the most money. Because also, you know, it's kind of like real estate, where if you make, the landowner makes money, the consultant forester makes money.
Exactly. Yeah. And there, like you say, there's a balance in there between watching the markets and getting the timber cut when you needed to, like we had discussed. But you have some leeway within there with a year. If you're not waiting until the last minute and you're at that, oh God, we got to get this cut kind of stage, then, you know, there's definitely some leeway to watch some of those markets, because they fluctuate a lot.
They do. Yeah.
The other thing too is that a lot of people don't realize is that they will be out there when it's getting cut.
Yeah.
So they're watching the crew, they're counting the loads. You know, so making
sure they're accountable. They're making, mm-hmm. they're going back through and saying, well, you forgot that turn tree. It's like a turn tree is where, you know, you have a skid trail down a thing of planted pines, and that big skidder turns with that load of logs to go to the ramp. Well, it's going to end up hitting a tree every time. So then you remove all that bark. So sometimes the logger crew get to go back out there and cut that tree down. So that consulting forester will find those trees that they've missed, or, you know, the canopy's open, forks, like that. So, yeah, they are the landowner's eyes and ears on the ground, and they're holding those loggers accountable. And, you know, if they've been doing it long enough, they know who's good loggers and who's bad. So they're going to not work with some, and they're going to want to work with others.
Yeah. They're, you know, like our consultant, we get all, and I'm sure with all of them, you get, you know, the load sheets. It shows you what the tonnage was, what the price was, where it went. So you get all that. So you see that they're being honest on what they're giving you. And then they take whatever they need to do. He handles, you know, the county taxes, which a lot of people don't realize.
Right.
You have to pay a county tax.
Yes,
I do. Yes.
Which is aggravating. But it's supposedly to offset, I guess, road usage
with some legislation. Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, it's ridiculous. But anyway, that it's great to have that consultant in there to know all those little nuances and where everything needs to go. And like I said, they're there to check because, you know, we're an hour away from property or 45 minutes or so, but I can't be there every day that the timber crew was there.
Right. Yeah.
And so hopefully they're watching.
Yeah, and they keep the, make sure the boundary and the essence of the loggers as far as they're
right.
Yeah. As long as it's a good consultant, you should be in good hands.
But yeah.
We just really push, you know, and they're going to have a contract too. So there's going to, you know, they usually have in there that the loggers need to fix roads if they mess them up or gates.
Yeah, you could just talk to folks and ask who they've used.
Mm-hmm.
Most, you know, anybody that's been for a while is going to have a consultant that they'll tell you yes or no on. And with some of them that have done it long enough, like you said, they know the logging crews and they'll say, this guy works with a bunch of logging crews, but this guy, he does a great job. He's not going to skin up your trees.
Mm-hmm.
They won't leave trash behind. That's something I've noticed a lot depending on the crews.
Yeah.
Is some of them will leave a lot of trash behind and some of them pick up everything.
They're empty.
Even Coke cans and water bottles and stuff. I've been on properties. And like, oh my gosh, what did y'all do?
Yeah.
But then, you know, the ones that we've used before, then they take all their trash with them.
And then if you've got a good consulting forester, there's usually some loggers that'll pick working with, if they, you know, if they've got two properties that they need to go to, they'll pick the consulting forester that they like working with more. They'll go to them first or their traps.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we've done on doubts and I've done a lot of work with, you know, and I know you have as well, with like endangered species, things like that. So with gopher tortoises, you know, we have to go out and mark burrows to keep the trucks and stuff off it. And the right crew will avoid that and do a good job and will actually babysit what's happening out there. But you also need to make sure that whoever you're working with, if you have a wildlife objective, that they understand the goals of that landowner. Because so many times we go out and say, no, we really wanted it to go down to a 40 basal or even 60 sometimes. And you would think that they would be excited to take that much. But if they're not used to cutting that way, it feels like they're doing
something. You can't get them below 70.
Yeah. So they don't want to get in trouble, which is great. But that's where it's important to have the forester out there that understands, no, I really want to take this volume out. And they will pay attention to it. They'll hopefully avoid tortoise burrows and your sensitive plant areas.
Yeah.
And things like that. And they understand that. And they know it's there's special parameters that they kind of have to watch out for.
Yeah, we've all learned over the years that there's some consultants who are a lot better at managing on the wildlife side of things.
Correct.
Who knows how to mark for those lower basal areas or whatever the needs are, and you don't have to babysit them versus those that are, they're going to go out there and they're going to operator select and it's, you're going to be still sitting at a 70, 80 basal
with
area.
With forked trees because the logger, the guy on the operator
can't look up.
Right. He can't go behind where he's cutting.
Right. Yeah.
No, that our same neighbor that has the easement, the husband's a big quail hunter and the wife's a big turkey and deer hunter. And we were lucky enough to have, it hadn't been managed, or it hadn't been harvested like 15 years. So there was lots of, you know, undersized hardwoods, but not good hardwoods. So there was probably 80 acres of that place that they couldn't hunt because they just couldn't see to hunt in it. And so the logging crew, they were lucky that it was a fuel wood crew too. So like they told the guy, the forester obviously, and then the landowners lived there. So they talked to him a lot, but the guy that cut down this is a big deer hunter too. So he's like, I know where to, what to leave and what to take. So he was like leaving some bedding areas, but then cleaning out other areas. So we mapped it out and I think they gained about 70 acres of huntable land now.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. The right cut down machine operator.
Big difference.
Is huge. Yeah. I know people who, you know, but they work with certain companies. They're like, we want this cut down guy.
One of
the guys I work with, he'll even like bring you lunch and stuff. Because he knows that he's good. And he'll do the right thing. But hardwoods, something we haven't talked about.
Yeah.
That's a hard market.
We're both like, yes. I have to make sure, and we've seen a lot now, or I'm worried about seeing it, is, you know, everybody and their brothers was buying mulching machines in the last few years. So people were paying to have their properties mulched. But if they don't come back in, but if, I mean, y'all will do it though, but if those landowners don't come back in and like spray or burn afterwards, every one stem that they cut down of that mulching machine is going to have five, you know, sweet gum to come back from that.
May or may not have a bunch of China berry popping up.
It's really important. And I don't think it's something that we probably didn't think about till now where we're like, oh my gosh, that was all clean for a minute and mm-hmm. summer came, and now there's like five times as many young. So yeah. it's very important that
if someone mulch it again.
Right? Yeah, absolutely.
Pay them in that big money. Yeah.
No, you come in it and you either spray or hopefully, you know, if you're in those transition areas where you, maybe they left enough pines that you can have some burns go back in there and cut them down. But yeah, I've got a, that's something I'm very interested to see because there's been lots of call share to help with mulching.
Come on out.
Come on.
Well, that's the thing is the guys running the mulching machines don't understand or either don't bother to communicate with the landowner mm-hmm. who usually doesn't understand that that mulching
yeah,
is
going
to sprout.
Yeah, if you've got a mulcher out there, you probably haven't been managing for a while. So right. you're probably like, oh, look, it's a race. It's all, it's starting over. It's going to be yeah, here come the wire guys going to start coming in, yeah, no. get your plants. But yeah, no, you got to, you've got to then, that's just to kind of, start back over, but you've got to.
So then you can then address them because you can't. It's hard to spray all this.
Yeah, correct. But now this is at a manageable size where you can spray it mm-hmm. if it comes back up and you can't get fire in there. Yeah. So it might be where you mulch it, then have to spray it the next year, and that left enough canopy or you know enough sunlight for grasses to come back where you start yep. burning again. But yeah, it's hardwoods is the interesting.
And one. There's not especially South Georgia. There's Killer more so in North Georgia. Our hardwoods that we see don't have a lot of marketable value to
nope.
them.
Right.
No. So North Georgia, you'd be in a little bit different situation, but
yeah.
it's very limited on what our markets are.
And that's like one of the things on pot mills. Yeah. But down here, I guess we've got like Coastal. Is it Coastal? It's in like Havana, Florida. I think they do like hardwood pallets, stuff like yep. that. Mm-hmm. So again.
And there's a veneer place.
Yeah. Too. So we're, again, Southwest Georgia. I kind of forget how fortunate we are with the type of timber markets we've got. But yeah. There's some areas where you're literally having to pay somebody just to cut the hardwoods down.
If you're lucky enough to be in your pellet mill or whatever, then they'll take some of that fuel.
And there's not that many of those in the one in Albany.
Yeah. And like with our place, they are like, oh, yeah, we'll come in, we'll take the hardwoods and thin out the pines and do the thing, but we want your cypress. So that's the other thing, too. Is
yeah.
Sometimes you have to make a trade.
Yeah. And that's. Deal. Of the hardwoods, that's probably the most merchantable one now. But that stinks because that's such a unique ecosystem.
Yeah,
and it takes forever to come back. And most of our easements that are in this area, it specifically says, like, you cannot cut your site.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It makes a mass one.
Yeah.
That too slow to come back in. Yeah, there's no. They're too limited on those really big ones anymore. They're not there.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't cut my cypress if I had them. I have one.
We've got more than one on the river, so we got a couple, but. It's but when it comes to, like wildlife management with the hardwoods, it's really good to have that forester out there, consulting forester, to pick the right ones to leave.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Like you want to leave your white oaks and your if you got some. Our neighbors had a native or natural like crab apple, stuff like that. So nice. Leaving those, yeah. So again, that's really important to communicate with. First of all, have a good consulting forester and communicate with them what your goals and objectives are, and if you're lucky enough, some people are lucky enough to have those good. Mass producing hardwoods for wildlife, what you can for sure take every gum you got.
Yeah, water oaks and sweet gums, they can all go away or just be knocked down. Which is a lot of times we recommend that
around a water oak, it'll fall over.
Oh, yeah, but that's what we recommend. But you know, if you've got a logging crew out there in your pines, have them either take or just knock down if they will.
Yeah,
all of those unwanted hardwoods. Yeah. Now, if you've got, like you said, if you've got stuff you want to keep, make sure you flag those to so that they don't get. Knocked up and run over. But if they've got a hardwood stand and they're willing to take some of that, even if you're practically having to pay them.
Yeah, I'll do it. It's cheaper than getting somebody in there to cut each tree down. Right.
Cutting is a whole lot easier than taking the
and a tree service
mulching machine. Yeah. How much is that an acre now? It's like $400 an acre for a mulching
machine? I want to say it was $1,500 to have it for a week. I don't know how many hours he could. I don't know. I told him not to do it, so I didn't pay attention to it. I said, there's other ways to handle this. But he was, that's the other thing. It's like mowing syndrome.
Oh, yeah.
We talk about that all the time. And he needed to get on a mulcher and go out and seek destroy.
Destroy so things.
I was like, go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead. And then I said, we've got to burn it. We've got to spray it. We've got to do something. Because like you said,
it's going to come back fivefold.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So has anybody looked at, like when you do come in and mulch, you've got all of that material on the ground now. When you run a fire through that, how is that impacting your residual trees?
I don't know if they're hot. Yeah, they're not. Especially because you think about it, or I would think about it, if you're in an area where you haven't had a mulcher come in there, there probably hasn't been fire for a real long time. So there's probably already too much fuel on there.
Well, I mean, just look at that at the entrance to my place where we heated all that mulching.
Yeah.
I mean, it is, there's huge stuff, and we haven't been able to get in there to do anything to it because it's been so wet.
Yeah, but I guess you would want to do it like, because we had that good rain two nights, maybe go in there and try to burn some on Sunday. Take
some of that layer off.
Yeah, little by little.
Eat those layers away. Yeah.
So yeah, that's like knowing, it's all, yeah, it's a good point too. It's just like who you're working with, making sure that they know the history of what has or hasn't been there for a while. Because, you know, there was, I was working for an internship up near Plant Vogel, and they came in and burned these mature longleaf that hadn't been burning forever, and they were all dead within 2 years because they killed that. The duff layer was so thick that it killed all the roots.
Yeah, we were talking about that with a fire talk yesterday. Is you got to be really careful when, let's say, 15 years is considered never burned.
That's great.
Even if it's been burned before. Yeah. So even if you burned it, you know, once and then it has been 15 years, you basically have just started over again. Because it will affect all those little feeder roots. And that's what I've kind of been wondering about with some of this mulching is that going to sit there and just kind of smolder and then...
Okie finoke.
Yes. That doesn't really degrade as quickly as you would think it would either.
We need to do some new
stuff.
Because I'm sure they've done it.
Or somebody said
So if somebody's done it, let me know.
Especially like, we all talk about those invasives. Unfortunately, with like, you know, forestry stuff, you don't really find out, and wildlife, you don't find out till it's way too late.
This isn't good at all.
That's not a good idea.
Yes, exactly. So if you had a landowner who was looking to balance their economics, so they needed to pay, you know, insurance and taxes and all that kind of good stuff on a property, and they had a 50-acre property that was loblolly stand, and they were hitting 18 years, they've never thinned.
Ooh.
What's going to be the recommendations?
Thin immediately, and then, but you got to thin like all 50 acres probably, because you can't really split that in half to kind of offset incomes because of your safe. I'd have them reach out or find a good consulting to do that first thing. If they're wanting to hunt it, then it down to 60, put fire back in, look at it, have it evaluated 7 years.
Because that's, you know, a lot of what we see is landowners who it's just kind of slipped through the cracks, or they didn't think it was necessary. We plant trees and we don't do anything with them.
Right. Yep.
And then now we've got a mess, and all of a sudden a grandchild or a child's grown up enough that they've decided they want to hunt and we want to improve things. So we deal with a lot of those folks who are coming in behind the eight ball already.
Yeah. A lot of absentee land, especially you know, or passing or watching the kids living in it, they see, ooh, we can clear cut it, get a ton of money, and then not put anything back into it because it's forest. It'll come back and it'll come back in pines, and all it does is come back in sweet gum.
Yep.
And then you're like, well, this isn't what I wanted 5 years on the road. And then you're having to put even double what you would have put into it initially to get it back into pines.
Well, that brings up a point, you know, too, is offsetting. What are your thoughts on offsetting, like, hunting leases?
Right.
You know, dropping your basal area at this point. Because, I mean, hunting leases are getting good money.
You get some of us fools from Florida up here. I mean, our neighbor is leasing. There's a clear cut. Oh, there's some standing pine. $40 an acre, because it's Worth County, and Worth County is just for deer. So yeah, if you can offset it with, and again, you got to do your research and have good people that lease the place. I would we would appreciate it as South Georgia if you would lease it to us.
Exactly.
But I'm not paying $40 an acre.
Yeah, yeah.
So I do think that's a really good, especially for absentee landowner, a good way to offset the cost of owning a acreage, especially if it's in between thinnings or needing to burn or do some work out there and put money down to spray some stuff. But yeah, if, with the right
need that contract and do's and don'ts.
Yeah, don't do a handshake.
No, those are a nightmare. So definitely a contract with a term on it.
Yeah, and just do it yearly. It ends and we'll reevaluate.
That's right.
There was a lawyer wrote out the lease for bird rights on a well-known place in Florida, and it basically was written out that he was the only one that could cancel the lease.
Smart lawyer.
So we talked about leases being another way to get income from a forest stand. And one thing I'm kind of leery on talking about sometimes is pine straw. Yeah. But if it's done the right way, I mean, you're at canopy closure for a certain period of time. There's nothing but pine straw on the ground anyway. I say make use of that because that's some really good economics if you've got longleaf.
Yes.
But again, you got to choose the right crew.
Yes, that's very important.
Got to have a good contract with them and tell them that they're not spraying and nuking that stand underneath it, because then when you do thin, there's going to be nothing coming back up underneath your stand.
Yeah, it's basically just a giant fire break. But again, that's just really important to, if you, again, drive past somebody that's raking and you like the way it looks and the way it's done, talk to the landowner and figure out who's, and kind of reach out. But again, have a really good contract. But I think it's good, like you said, when the canopy's closed. But then in my mind, that's still taking nutrients away later on, because those pineapples do deteriorate at some point.
That's one of the few times I've seen recommendations on doing some.
It's a cat, by the way.
That's right. We had a little.
Our stomachs are growling. They love pine straw raking.
Growling. Stomachs are really good.
Sounds like it.
But that's when fertilization, a lot of times, are recommended if you've been doing a lot of straw raking.
Yeah. So then that's an added cost.
So there is a balance on that. Yeah. But just, you know, you can get a couple hundred dollars an acre with a good long leaf. Yes, on a yearly contract. But
back in McRae, what, $10
That's what I'm hearing. That's something that's going down because you got a lot more long leaf.
Yeah. And,
but yeah, I'm hearing a lot of $300 an acre.
Can I try to squirrel for a second?
Yeah.
As a northerner, why do you put something that is flammable against your house to decorate?
That's not what we call firewood.
What is the pine straw?
And you gotta do it yearly. I put rocks around our house. I want you to like rocks.
Now with my boys, those rocks are
Jesse has her pile of rocks, but we've been just doing rocks because you don't have to replace them. Like,
that's absolutely a lot easier to keep from. Get with the question.
It's supposed to be pretty. And
it is pretty.
And then it brings in all the invasive species. And
That's
the other thing too, is
like hiding spots.
Black widows. You need to make sure that you're treating invasive species before you start raking.
Yes.
Yeah. Invasives, yes. But I've seen some areas where the crew wanted it so clean that they went in here and sprayed so much it wasn't killing off some of the pines.
Ben Hill County. Same thing where the land having come out, what's wrong with these rows of trees? Guys are raking spray leaves.
Yeah. And those really heavy sands. Yeah. I see it a lot in East Georgia.
It'll be sandy.
Yeah,
they are just destroying it. And then when they thin, there's nothing left. And then their trees are all nasty and dying off.
Yeah. So, water quality, soil quality.
Yeah.
It's a short-term gain and long-term damage.
Yeah.
And I've seen some people delay thinning because they're getting the money from the long.
And then they wonder why they don't get good return later.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the trees start dying and we're back to them. They'll thin themselves if you don't take care of it. No. One other thing I thought about when we were discussing was, as we were saying, a lot of the ladies who are managing the stands, their husband passed away. It was kind of now to them. And so this is probably something they didn't deal with when their husband was alive. So we have a lot of ladies out there who are trying to figure this out. And some of them are really easy for these less scrupulous consultants. Right. Mm-hmm. So how do ladies get that confidence and where do they go? Or do you have some recommendations?
Yeah. So for that, what we recommend is to reach out, again, go to our geotrees.org and find our website, and you can find your county forester or forestry. And they can come out and actually write you a management, or they can just give you a letter with some recommendations, or they can write you a 10-year management stewardship. And that kind of gives you a year by year thing of what to do on each, and it outlines the property. And that's all free. That's all, good old tax dollars going to work. But then again, you can also just reach out to your neighbors. If you like what you're seeing with them, find out who they're using or what they're doing it. But there's lots of things right there at your fingertips. You can call DNR if you want some wildlife help or anything like that.
The agencies that aren't getting revenue from what you're doing for your management are probably going to give you a little bit better recommendation because they don't have a buy-in on it.
Yeah. It's just very important. And it's kind of funny. My biggest fear growing up was asking questions, but now I always ask questions. So the older I get, the more I realize how it really is important, and don't be ashamed to just, if you're curious, ask. And there's things that you might ask you might ask a question and find out things that you had no idea about, which more questions, more discoveries and things like that. So I would definitely reach out to your government agencies or your neighbors and see what kind of assistance we've got. So we could do that management plan, then we can also point you in the direction of cost share. So send you to the NRCS office, FSA office, and help you get some cost share to help with the property or the just starting over.
Yeah, that was the one thing we didn't talk about, was another way to offset some of your costs.
Cost share.
It's cost share. Yeah,
and it's right. Beneficial to be a woman landowner nowadays with that cost share stuff, or it can be beneficial.
Yeah, and another, you know, to find that forester too, there's some good resources for the Society of American Foresters.
Yes.
There's Tree Farm. There's lots of other places if you're not in Georgia, you know, find stuff. But yeah, you start with your local.
Because with GFC, every county is covered by a forester. There might be like, you know, one forester per four or five counties, but you've got somebody there and they're familiar with the area, with the economy, contractors.
Good resource. Mm-hmm. So two thoughts. It's kind of coming up close to an hour, so I'm going to start wrapping things up. That's all right. But it's been a good conversation and good information. What have you seen, and I guess it's going to be to anybody, what have we seen in shifts in our bone? Back this up. What have we seen in shifts in maybe burn in our timber culture over the last few years?
Particulates. That's how mad I am.
That's how we feel about it.
Regulating when we can burn.
The stress just really elevated in this room. Because I had to listen to this all day yesterday.
It is getting harder to burn.
Because it's the easy thing to pick on.
It's the easy thing to pick on. And then if they keep it up, we're going to be like Canada in the West, where it's just going to be catastrophic wildfires.
Which are worse for the environment.
Correct.
Than people. Instead of smoke for a day, it's going to be smoke for weeks.
Yeah.
This probably needs to be another rant.
So it is getting harder and harder to burn, and it scares the bejesus out of me. Because again, it's really good for wildlife. It's really good for just the economy in Southwest Georgia when it comes to like how much money is brought in for quail plantation and hunting and stuff like that. It's just good for the forest health. But heaven forbid somebody have to cough for a day. But it also happens the same like this during like pollen season. So it could also be.
Yeah, it's not just
smoke.
It's our pollen season.
If the thing is like we're triggering a monitor, which basically keeps track of how much smoke's in the air and how much of these particulates are being registered. No, it needs to be reassessed, but again,
so we put a bag over it.
Like you said, those pecan blowers.
But this is like one of the things that people need to know about.
It's terrible.
And, you know, we're having a tough time as it is getting landowners to understand, like, you can do this safely. You can get help with it. There's lots of resources to help you have a safe prescribed fire on your property plan.
So critical.
You know, and that should be allowed because, like you said, it prevents wildfires, which, I mean, how many wildfires do we have around here?
Not very many. But if we do, it's like 2 acres.
Right. Yeah. You know, there's some exceptions in places that have blown up, but those are where they have
taken fire out of them.
I mean, this is the whole problem out west.
Yeah.
But the thing is, in the meeting yesterday, and it showed that they were picking on prescribed fire to limit air quality because that was the easiest thing to do.
Right.
Like they don't,
because we don't impact the big industries.
That's right. They don't think the community is going to talk about. So what we don't talk about is things like burning your trash in your backyard. Don't burn your plastic in your backyard.
That's usually how most wildfires start.
Yes. And it's just, there's a lot of things going into this.
But the emissions, those solar panels, right.
And those piles produce a whole lot more smoke. It should be burned
out this Friday without, like,
I'm going to go to the liquor store after this. I remember when I first interviewed for the commission, they asked like what my experience was with prescribed burning. I was like, well, I learned what not to do watching my dad. So like, I was like, we burned some telephone poles then.
Did you roll a tire down
with
him?
Yeah.
Oh, I saw one dangling the other day.
Oh, really?
The whole bottom of it was gone. Oh, it's just like poles dangling.
Burning where you didn't have to have a permit. Right. Like, right. It was just go for it.
What is Vimex?
Yeah. Insurance. You gotta, if it's, you know, we're trying that little, down here, we're trying to really take it or fix this particulate thing where we're getting more strict on when we can allow burn permits, like with the transport wind. So, like, there's I'm sure there's been less acreage because there's been more, or there's been, you know, iffy days where the transport went like 4 miles per hour, so people got turned down.
So the transport wind is something that helps move the smoke.
Moves the smoke
out. Mm-hmm. And it's surprising that you actually want a higher wind. People are like, well, that doesn't sound safe.
At a certain point.
Yeah. Which is part of the problem, though, is that, you know, landowners, people that who aren't as experienced with putting fire on the ground are like, wait, you're wanting me to burn when there's a wind?
Yeah.
Like, and it's like, that's not what we mean.
Yeah. Not the winds that we have today at 20 miles an hour.
Yesterday.
Not the blustery, you know, piglet's going to fly past you kind of thing. It's a
and then like another issue too is just liability, like lawsuits, like if you know car accidents that could have happened from the smoke, you're going to the cleaner, like they're taking you to the cleaner for lawsuits. So that's a big issue concern.
But some states are also handling that through
Georgia
and through you getting, you know, making sure it's not, you have to really prove negligence.
Yes.
Yeah.
And if you got that permit, it's supposed to take cover up.
And that's why we're really past a lot of places in the southeast is that we're trying to protect the landowner
as much as we can
to keep it going, and also protect our agencies and protect our burn bosses from that liability if something happens. And you know, we even see sometimes, you know, arson happening during one of our prescribed fires, so starting like picking some of that stuff out.
We see a pick of arson in the beginning of
anyways, that's a
And that's, you know, a benefit with GFC is get that permit because that reduces your liabilities because of Georgia's liability, whatever they call it, state where you the liability is basically put on the burden of the person who's suing, basically, is what it comes down to. That makes complete sense, But yes, that's what that is there for, the getting that permit, or one reason that is there. It helps reduce your liability issues if you have called in and you have that permit number, and working with a consultant or someone with GFC to have the burn plan in place, all those good things. That's
the most consultants carry insurance now,
right?
But that also ups the cost of
But you know, again, it's
worth it
or getting your training.
The other thing too is like be involved. Like you have to talk to leadership, state leadership, your politicians,
local.
Yeah, make sure that they're engaged and they're on the right side of the argument.
My cousin's representative, or was, I think his last term, he had no idea that there was issues with down here.
I mean, they don't know until we send them a white paper they have to read, or you know, it impacts their backyard.
Like, they're regulating like how much we can burn down here. That's where
get engaged.
Definitely. I mean, everything that you read or talk to, you know, you might not own land, but somebody's land impacts you.
And I know we have a lot of professionals that are listening to this right now,
you know,
and like we forget that we are also engaged in that conversation too. So we don't have to wait on a landowner that we work with to write the letter. Like we can write the letter. We are also citizens. We're also landowners. Yep. We can do it too.
Yeah. Good point. So kind of a final takeaway is, why is timber management important to the general public? Why should they care?
As my daughter thinks, it provides oxygen.
There you go.
She told me that the other day. I was like,
and log trucks are good.
Yeah, log trucks are good.
Maybe not the emissions.
Just don't drive.
I have trees to breathe.
So why is timber management? This actually goes, like, you know, with my easements and legacy lands, you know, helping purchase like WMAs and stuff. It just provides water quality for everybody in Georgia, Florida, Alabama. It provides clean air. It provides, you know, habitat for that wildlife that you want to hunt or watch. It's just really critical. And again, like you mentioned earlier, tax dollars. If it's well-managed timber, then it's harvested, and I get just the economy itself statewide. It employs so many, probably hundreds of the people in the forest industry. And I think it's our second biggest industry.
Yes.
One or two. And then we're also one of the biggest in the nation. I think we're, No, it's just really important. I mean, like, again, like, you might not own land, but somebody's land impacts without your...
Yeah, all the things that come out of forest products.
Yeah. Imagine a pandemic without toilet paper.
Oh, yeah. Lord. Just that alone should be enough.
There's pine products and potato chips, toothpaste.
Yeah.
So it's things that you don't ever think about.
And the packaging they're in and the house you live in.
Yeah.
Well, and the thing is, like, it is absolutely sustainable.
Yeah.
So
absolutely.
A lot of people, you know, don't print this out, save the trees, which, yes, we don't want to be excessive or
we aren't
wasteful, but this is part of our problem why we can't manage our it for wildlife, because there's no market.
Yeah.
And
one of my pet
peeves, it's a sustainable market,
was when we're going to save the trees by using plastic bags.
Oh,
when that started, and then I was like, why? It's a renewable resource. Yeah. I mean, maybe, yeah, you don't want to go cut down redwoods and make paper bags out of them, but that's not our community.
It's like the cheese that's like stored in the ground somewhere, American cheese.
Oh, gosh.
Like dairy.
Till next time.
I do a conspiracy theory.
What's your conspiracy theories? But yeah, no, it's just really important. And I think it goes back to like growing up watching Fern Gully. You just automatically think cutting down a tree is the worst thing in the world. But I know in Georgia, I guess they'd say that for every one tree we cut, we plant three, like that.
Yeah.
So it's very sustainable. And we're still learning more products that can make.
Yep. That, I think that's an important thing for the public to realize, is that it is sustainable and it's very important to our economy.
Yes.
And to the environment, which people are, you know, supposedly so environmentally conscious now. Sure. We have to manage them.
There's preservation, which is, another
preservation side of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, we talked about preservation and conservation in another one. So
yeah.
We definitely want to go there. Well, I think these were some great topics and discussion. We appreciate you coming in and ranting with us today.
Yeah.
Taking a few squirrels here and there.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Do this again at some point, and we appreciate everybody for listening, and hope you like and follow us on whatever podcast platform you're on, and follow us on Facebook. See you next time. Thank you.
Thanks.